Hi, my name is Brendan Malone and you're listening to The Dispatches, the podcast that strives to cut through all the noise in order to challenge the popular narratives of the day with some good old-fashioned contrarian thinking. You might not always agree, but at least you'll be taking a deeper look at the world around you. Hi everybody, welcome along to another episode of The Dispatches. Thanks for tuning in. Wherever you're listening right now, whatever platform you're on, why not hit that subscribe or that follow button so that you can stay up to date about all of the episodes as they arrive. I was going to say to air, but it's not quite a live broadcast, is it? But as they are published, you'll be able to get instant notification, and it's just a whole lot easier to follow the content that we're putting out. Before I jump into today's topic of conversation, I just want to say a couple of things. And the first thing I want to say is this: for those who are wondering, this is not just a COVID podcast. And I felt that I had to really reiterate that point because I know the first six episodes have been about COVID-related issues, but it's not by design. Okay, this trust me, this is not a COVID-only podcast. That's definitely not my intention. I'm actually a little bit frustrated by the fact that sort of COVID is really such a dominating thing. But the reason it is such a dominating thing on this podcast at the moment is because the focus of the podcast is on sort of cultural and social issues, that sort of the big stuff of the day that's flying around, trying to sort of apply a broad principle-based approach and asking questions that I think are pertinent, and a lot of that sort of current affairs-based stuff that's happening. And at the moment, of course, the big dominant issue is COVID and COVID-related questions. So there's going to be a few more episodes yet that sort of touch on this, but I promise you that I've got a whole list of other topics that have got nothing to do with COVID that are just waiting in the wings. And as I said, I don't want to get into the minutiae of debating individual news stories and personalities. What I want to do is I want to try and take a more broad-based approach that sort of, here's my hope, that I can help to, and I say this with absolute humility, recognizing my own failings and flaws, like every human being has. But my hope is that we can sort of shine a little bit of a light, even if we're asking the right questions, shine a little bit more of the light of truth on some of these issues, and perhaps find ourselves, all of us, myself included, getting a bit deeper and going a bit deeper into the truth of various matters. So yeah, it's not just a COVID podcast, I absolutely promise you that. Now, the other thing I want to talk about, and this, I want to say a few things about this other point before we get into the episode, but in the previous episode, those who tuned in for the previous episode, I referred to a preprint study about myocarditis in 12 to 17-year-olds. And one thing that it was remiss of me, and I want to say this because I know that I think one of the big issues in the media right now is there's a tendency for things to be rushed, or for when more correct data becomes available. It's not often you hear people correcting themselves. And my desire, as I said, is to really try and shine a light of truth on stuff and also to be absolutely honest. And it stings sometimes to admit that you were wrong or to put challenging counter evidence on the table. But I'm actually only interested in the truth. So I think this podcast, I really want to be a place where, as things shift, and they do, they're shifting and moving quite rapidly in a novel virus where we don't know as much as at times we like to think we know. We're still learning. And that means that, you know, perhaps mistakes are going to be made, or things are not going to be 100% clear, or there's going to be developments. And so in that particular spirit, one thing that I should have mentioned last time and I didn't, and it was remiss of me, I just forgot to, there's nothing sinister about this, I just forgot to mention this, was the fact that I should have clarified that a preprint study is a study that hasn't yet undergone peer review. And so what that means is that study I referred to about myocarditis, please understand this, it could, once it goes through the peer review process, it could end up that the peer review process shows that there were flaws in that study, and so the conclusions that it's making are not valid, or it might show that there were just some minor tweaks that need to be made, and so the results might be a bit more narrow. So I really feel it's important to stress that point, and I apologize that I just forgot to clarify and make that clear about that particular study. In that vein, I had a friend of mine who tunes into the podcast episodes and has been enjoying them, and she teaches a media studies class, and she said she's been enjoying putting them before the students, but she said, well, what do you think about this? And she put forward a particular website that critiqued that particular study that I referenced in the last episode. So I just wanted to highlight people. There are people, and this is not the peer review process, though. I want to make that clear. This is someone on a... I spoke to a friend of mine about this who's an actual scientist, a medical researcher in this space who's doing work in the COVID space, and said, I sent the website link and I said, you know, can you give me a sort of expert opinion? He said, look, trust the peer review process and let it do its job. He said, this website, it might turn out to be valid what they're claiming, but it's not that's not the peer review process. This is an actual, it's called science-based medicine, but they are actually, they have a particular position. So they are rightly, and I don't mean in a negative sense, they are would rightly be called a science activist sort of website. And so that potentially could create bias and conflicts of its own. But the article that was sent to me was titled Peer Review of a VAERS, V-A-E-R-S, Dumpster Dive. And it was responding to that particular study about myocarditis that's in preprint that I was talking about. And here's the byline. A new preprint study on COVID vaccine myocarditis dives into the VAERS dumpster with predictable and embarrassing results. Now, one thing I'd say straight away is where you see that kind of emotive and inflammatory sort of language, that's a big warning sign that there's a possibility you need to be a bit more careful about what lies ahead and whether what you're about to read is just purely scientific and dispassionate and a proper dispassionate look at the evidence, or whether it's actually coming from a place of bias. And because here's why. Generally, when scientists are doing actual science, there's a genuine respect that they have for each other. Unless someone is doing something truly corrupt and unethical, you might find that there is a stronger condemnation. But generally, when you've got scientists who are doing ethical science, they have a respect for each other and they don't talk about each other in these kinds of terms. They're not derogatory. They just focus on the evidence, on what they think the flaws might be, the strengths might be, and they tend to give you a very dispassionate sounding appraisal of things. They are measured. They are not emotive. And so this straight away is a little bit of a warning fire in this a warning sign with this article. And so, yeah, that would be my response is, read widely and going on the advice of my friend who is actually an expert, is trust the peer review process and don't be afraid of that. And if the peer review process, because what this article was indicating, they looked at 7 out of the 257 cases that the study I referred to, the preprint study, looked at, and they said, well, there's some questionable hinky things about 7 of these cases, which may mean that they should be excluded. However, there's another 250 cases as well. And so what they may have found is they may have found just some errors that need to be corrected, which may not have much of a bearing on the final findings. And interestingly enough, the lead author of the study, she actually replied in the comments section and said, look, we welcome this kind of scrutiny. And so she's very measured and very charitable about it, actually, even though some of the people who attacked her in the counter comments were not. She was very charitable. And that, as I said, those attacks point to an activism for me. And whereas there's a very scientific approach she's taking, and she's saying, look, let's just check the data. And we're happy to have this, and that's why they want the peer review process to happen. So it may mean that the peer review process shows, look, it was just 7 cases, or it might not even show that, I don't know. Or it might show, well, look, there's a much bigger problem here, the whole thing has to be discounted, but yeah, let the peer review process actually do its job. And I think that goes for either side of an issue, is be wary of activist-based websites. Don't be weary. Don't assume that they're not telling you the truth, because that would be a logical fallacy to assume, well, because this person's an activist, they're incapable of speaking truthfully. That's not true. They might be telling you the truth. Don't assume that a message is false just because you don't like the messenger or you don't normally agree with the messenger. What you've got to do is actually look at the content of the message. I think we need to be careful of in the situation is just ensuring that the potential biases that could be there, I think you have to take extra care, as opposed to a sort of a proper dispassionate scientific process. Here's the thing. I think we should all be willing to be wrong. And as I said, as much as it stings to be wrong, no one likes to be wrong. And it really does. It's a bit of your pride takes a bit of a hit to have to say, well, I got that wrong. But we should be willing to be wrong. And I'm striving to really embrace that motto and that philosophy in my own life. Because if I'm wrong and I discover that, that's actually a really beautiful thing. Because what it means is I've now discovered that there is a truth here that I wasn't living or believing or accepting previously, and now I'm free. And I find a greater level of freedom, by the way, by embracing that truth. And so that's actually a really good thing to be proved wrong if what you are wrong about is, you know, you believe a lie. And we should all welcome that. And I think all parties, it's one of the things that's really frustrated me is in this whole process, is it seems that there's sort of this sectioning off of certain science and scientists who are promoting certain perhaps policy responses or notions about COVID and treating them as if they're infallible, and then sectioning off another group and saying, well, they're idiots and they shouldn't be trusted because they're questioning what the infallible people are saying. I think all of us should be happy to be wrong. I mean, this is as much as it's not easy to be wrong and no one really wants to be wrong, but we should be happy to be proved wrong and certainly be willing to be wrong. I think that's an important stance to hold. So yeah, in future, and I promise you I'll do the best on this podcast, if things come across my desk which show that I got it wrong, I will actually make sure that I provide those corrections in this podcast so that you who are listening out there actually can get a proper handle on things and can have a sense of, okay, he's not trying to swing an agenda here, he is doing his best to try and present this as much as my human frailty and limited intellect and limited capabilities. I am not infallible and I am not omniscient and omnipresent. I can't be everywhere and know everything all at once. So, but I will do my best to sort of try and, let's be honest about this and learn as we go. Another piece of correspondence that I got in response to the last episode was from a friend of mine who's a doctor, and this person's great, by the way. She's actually working in the healthcare system in this country. She's in the hospital space. She's on the front lines right in our sort of one of our big COVID hotspots. And so, and she's someone I know who's a good, practical, ethical person who actually thinks well about these issues, who's not stuck in one particular agenda or bias or another, and is genuinely doing her best to apply a proper sort of Hippocratic, ethical, and rational approach to these issues. I actually told her, I said, I did wonder to myself whether you would listen to this episode and what you would think. So I'm glad she got in contact. She raised a very interesting point with me that I hadn't even considered, and I'm really grateful for her feedback, actually. You'll know that I've talked previously, or those who've maybe followed me on social media, I've written about this fixation on COVID itself and how I think that's an unhealthy thing, because when you fixate on something, you create a bias and a narrowing of your ability to analyze things and to think about things a bit more widely. And at a time like this, that's obviously something that's quite important. And so I've talked about the negative, but what I'd only done was I'd only really thought about that in relation to people fixating on COVID itself and COVID deaths and, you know, all those kinds of things. And so you get into all sorts of problems because of that fixation. But she raised a really good point with me, and she said this. I'm a doctor in the hospital space, and she said, I've had people who I've dealt with who have thought that they've had vaccine reactions, but in actual fact, we've discovered it's other healthcare issues at play. And the point she raised with me was that there is and there can be a fixation on the vaccine and vaccine side effects as well that creates a blurring of our vision, a fogging of the mind, a narrowing of our vision, and an inflating of things that shouldn't be inflated and all those kinds of things. And I thought that's a really good point. I hadn't considered that, and she's right. That fixation would also apply in that situation too. So again, it's really the danger here is fixation in any direction, but it's not something I'd really considered. And so, look, I'm grateful to have that kind of feedback. I think it's awesome. Like I said, I think we should all be willing to be wrong. And I think if more of us were actually having our dialogues, well, we're not having dialogues at the moment, but if we were having conversations about this issue with that, we would actually have dialogue. We'd have better conversations. It would be a really good thing, I think. And I think we'd probably be getting a lot closer to the truth, and we'd be getting some better solutions without all of the tribalism and intensity that's really manifesting in a very ugly way right now in the midst of all of this. So yeah, like I said, I think we should all be willing to be wrong, which reminds me just one other thing, he says, before I jump into today's topic of conversation. And related to this was that willingness to be wrong. As I saw the following meme someone had shared on social media this weekend, and it's a copy and paste or an image grab, a screen grab of a tweet that someone else had tweeted. And here's what they said, because this is the wrong way to go about things, I'd suggest. Here's what the tweet said. If you are not a scientist and you disagree with scientists about science, it's actually not a disagreement. You're just wrong. I'll come back to that point and why that is just so illogical in just a second. The person goes on to say this. Science is not truth. Science is finding the truth. When science changes its opinion, it didn't lie to you. It learned more. So let me tell you what I think is wrong with this tweet. So first of all, if you're not a scientist and you disagree with scientists about science, it's actually not a disagreement. You're just wrong. That is absolute nonsense. Scientists are not infallible. They're not. And this person has created a level of sort of unassailable infallibility that they are administering to people because they have a science qualification and when they're talking about science. That's not how science works. Just remember that the first people to actually do science were not qualified. They didn't have a degree in science. It didn't exist, remember, before we started giving degrees in it. And here's the thing about science. Science is actually it's a method. It's a way of looking at information about the natural world. It obviously has its limitations, but it's a way of looking at claims that are being made about, and this is a very loose sort of definition, I get it, but it, you know, you get the gist of this, of claims that are being made about the natural world and about things that are happening. It's about observing things. It's about putting forward a hypothesis for why things are the way they are. And then it's about, you know, using various techniques that are recognized universally for testing the validity of those claims. You know, so things that, you know, falsifiability and you know, controlled measurements and, you know, all those kinds of things that are part of science. So what that means is that if you don't need to have a science degree to actually do science, if you use that methodology and that approach to information, and where it's appropriate to do that, obviously, because some bits of information, you know, science is limited and it can't make definitive pronouncements about morality. That's beyond the scope of what science can do. But let's say in this particular pandemic, if you take information or data or occurrences, you observe them and you apply those rules, those principles of science to them, it is possible that a layperson with no recognized qualification in science could actually discover something or come up with something and have an insight that a person who has a science qualification might have missed. Now, you know, the general norm is that it works the other way around, but it can happen. And that's because you are not bestowed with infallibility. You're not immune to bias just because you have a science qualification. So this tweet is the wrong way to go about things. And here's the interesting thing, if we carry on with the second part of the tweet. Science is not truth. Science is finding the truth. So he's actually just contradicted himself there. When you think about it, you know, science is not truth. You're right. And so scientists are not infallible truth givers. That's the key point. It's about they are truth seekers. That they don't have an unassailable area of specialist knowledge that a person who is capable of thinking well and applying those same principles, you know, is somehow roped off from and is incapable of engaging with. It's crazy. Anyway, then he carries on. When science changes its opinion, it didn't lie to you. It learned more. I don't know of anyone who's saying that science is lying to us. I think what people are saying is they're accusing individuals of not being truthful. But more commonly, what I'm seeing is people are actually reacting and getting frustrated. I think the deeper issue is they're getting frustrated with the scientific hubris that's being shown. And I think a lot of that particular problem he's identified, it's a different issue now, the second part of the tweet, it wouldn't be so much of a problem if there wasn't this bold, definitive, sort of almost divine infallibility, the way in which these sort of pronouncements are being made. Because the simple fact is, this is a moving feast. We're learning more, things are adapting, things are changing, new variants change the game, all those kinds of things. And so I think if there was a little bit more humility and a bit more of a presenting of the evidence and saying, look, here's the best available data we have right now, and here's what we think this means for policy, and here's what we think you can do, but please be aware this is the best available data. We would encourage you to do X, Y, and Z, but it may, and that may change in future as more and better data and information becomes available. if things were being presented in that sort of light, I don't think this would be as much of an issue. What's happening, though, is you get this bold declaration, this classification of, no, this is absolutely true. There doesn't seem to be much room for questioning the sort of various policy lines or whatever they might be. Then, you sort of start classifying people into groups and saying, well, they accept what we're telling them as sort of infallible and unassailable. And there's another group who just want to question it. Those people are dangerous. They're a threat. All that kind of stuff, that politicization, what that actually does, that's where the problem lies. If everyone was just saying, look, this is the best available knowledge, but we can learn more. We don't need to have hubris about this. We just need a bit more humility. I don't think that would be as much of an issue. An example of this, just to finish up before we get to today's topic, was I saw an op-ed that appeared in the New Zealand Herald newspaper today, and it's an interesting one actually for me. A lady who had COVID, so this is an editorial that was published today in the Herald. Let me just give you the basic gist of it. She clearly appears to be someone who has either senior connections or is senior in journalism. She's got some connection that allowed her to publish an editorial, and also she talks about engaging with Michael Baker, so I'm assuming she has some connection or some role that allows her to do that. But the experience was this: their son, and I'm assuming it's an adult son or an older child, got COVID. They all live in the same house. Got sick, and they thought, oh, maybe it's COVID. So they started wearing masks and physical distancing where possible from their son. He goes in for the COVID test. He gets COVID. I think they were in the same vehicle together. He gets COVID. The COVID tester says, look, everyone in the house gets it, so just sort of prepare yourself for the fact that you'll probably get it. And then he ended up in quarantine. And then they went through, carried on with the various tests that you have, the 5-day test, and then the next test that you have. And they didn't, or she didn't get COVID. And so she's written this op-ed where she said, here's how we avoided it. And what she's done is she's made this bold declaration saying, masking and physical distancing in this ordinary Kiwi home, that was the trick. That was what stopped us from getting COVID. And so this is a really good thing, and it works. Now, I don't want to dispute that particular point. That's not the issue here. The issue here for me that was fascinating about this is there's a phenomena that's deeper here at play. Here you have a woman who's not a scientist, who did something that is not scientific, didn't follow any of the sort of safeguards of the the methodology and the rules of science. She took an anecdotal situation. She ignored all the what ifs, didn't even talk about them in the op-ed, and then at the end of that made a bold declaration about what she thinks it was. And by the way, she also said in the op-ed, she shared this with Michael Baker, and Michael Baker, she said in her op-ed, encouraged her to write about this, to write and publish an article about this, which is why I wonder if she's actually, it doesn't say who it is, but I'm assuming this person must have some connections or maybe is in the journalistic trade, and so I was able to do that. And he encouraged her to write about this. Now, what's interesting, as I said, is this is not a scientist, and they're not doing anything that really resembles science here. All the what ifs are ignored. Yet she's able to publish an article as an editorial in the media and make a declaration saying, look, this is proof of a particular policy or a setting or an approach. And I find that absolutely interesting, because other scientists who actually are more rigorous in their approach and who do follow more closely and more strictly different scientific controls and measures and methodologies, they are being called kooks. They're not allowed to be published. They're being censored at the same time just for questioning certain things. And this is interesting to me, because here's some of the what ifs that she ignored. So what if she's immune? What if she has some natural immunity to this? What if Delta is less transmissible in certain situations, like let's say certain climates or certain household arrangements and certain airflows, and maybe that's pertinent to where she is in her situation? What if she's on a particular treatment or therapy or medication that actually has a prophylaxis effect that we don't know about yet? So she's on it for some other reason, and it turns out, lo and behold, it has a prophylactic protective effect for people who against COVID. So all of those what ifs, they're not even talked about, but what is told is one of the other what ifs. Well, what if the masks and the distancing were definitely the thing that worked? Which is kind of interesting to me, because it does appear they're in the same vehicle together, which is kind of a very small space to try and maintain distancing. I'm not sure how that would work. But anyway, and then on top of this, when Michael Baker told her that she should write about this. And my first thought was, well, I wonder if Michael Baker would have told her to write about this if the scenario had been slightly different, and whether the Herald would have even published it if she had done the same. So the same thing had happened, but she hadn't worn a mask and she hadn't kept physical distance, and instead she had close contact with her son and she still didn't get COVID. She came out of it with no COVID. Would Michael Baker have encouraged her to write and publish an article about her experience? Would the Herald have run that article? I am highly skeptical that they would have. And what I'm not saying here is we shouldn't trust experts or we shouldn't trust any findings. What I'm saying is this points to the politicisation of the whole scientific endeavour and the public health policy. And I think that's the unhealthy point. I think that as long as you're not engaging in behaviours that are irrational, then I think we should welcome the questioning and we should welcome a robust, open questioning. As I said, as long as it's not irrational, and I think we should always be willing to be wrong. I think that's really, really important. Right, with that out of the way, 25 minutes or so in, let's actually now jump into the topic of conversation for today. Why shouldn't the media be running vaccination campaigns? And since actually preparing for the show, it's developed a little bit too, because it's not just the media. There's an article that I read just this morning. It's the title of it. It's on Radio New Zealand. Hospitality business considers no vax, no entry policy. Let me read you from the article. Sam Ainsley, the owner of Shaky Isles Coffee and the Bars, Everybody's, and Roxy, so several places he owns, plans to request proof of a COVID-19 vaccination card upon entry at his business in a month's time. He told Radio New Zealand he had talked the idea over with around 30 other Auckland hospitality operators, mostly from larger venues in the city, and about 75% were keen to do the same, which made me first think, are these people just so desperate to try and make money that they'll do anything? You know, I did wonder what the real motivation was, but that's another story. Ainsley expected to lose customers when lockdown lifts, but also gain others who want to feel safer. Every choice someone makes has a negative or a positive consequence. And if you choose to not get vaccinated, then potentially what you're going to do is reduce the number of options you've got, to have a really damn good time. Ainsley also hoped the government will also take note. Again, that's what made me wonder whether he's just sort of desperately saying, all these people are saying, look, if we comply with this idea, maybe they'll let us have lots of people in the room so we can make some more money out of this. If we can help and get our voices heard around that government table, which I think business really struggles with at the moment, then that's a good thing too. Here's the problem with this though. So before I get into the media vaccination campaign, this particular angle here, this is just so terribly flawed, because vaccinated people can still contract and they can still pass on the virus. And by the way, this article does not make mention of that once. Now, why is that interesting? Because other articles where people might present questions about policy, who are questioning the official policies, this one they're sort of generally going along and promoting their own version of a policy, generally what I've seen is the media has put the counterpoint in there as well and said, even though experts say X, Y, and Z, Sam Ainsley has said, you know, that would be the sort of tone that's missing noticeably from this article. But vaccinated people can still contract and pass on COVID. And that's not an insignificant rate or factor here. And so what that means is that even if you were socializing with purely vaccinated people, you still could contract and you still could then pass on to others COVID. So there's no real advantage here, and there's no advantage to actually socializing with the vaccinated only. Not just that, but the benefit of a vaccine really ultimately, what it does for the individual is that they are less likely to end up in hospital or to end up dying of COVID-19, and particularly if they're in certain cohorts or certain situations, that, you know, that's an important factor here. But what that means is if you're vaccinated and you go and hang out with unvaccinated people, you'll get a milder version of COVID. Well, certainly it's less likely to. I mean, some people that's not true, but most, it's the general norm, is that they don't end up with the same serious consequences. So there's really no advantage to you, health advantage to you personally either, by doing this. And here you've got the situation where effectively what then you've got is a group of businesses who are willing to punish people for not doing something, to act in a prejudicial way, to bar them from their premises for not doing something that they want them to do, for not taking a medical course of action that they want those people to take. And I think that's crossing a line. My hope is that the market will send a clear message and that even people who are vaccinated will say, look, I'm sorry, mate, but this is not on. You don't actually get to create. And I have resisted using this term up until now, but I do think there is some people are calling it medical apartheid. And I actually, when I read this, I did think, yeah, this is actually is a very unjust form of discrimination here that I'm not buying into. So I hope the market does send a clear message about this. By the way, if you're unvaccinated, you're always welcome in my home. Now, obviously, we haven't got anyone in our home who's got comorbidities or vulnerabilities, and that could change if that was the case. But other than that, I mean, there's no reason for you, and there's no reason for us to be separated in this way. So, yeah, I'm not going to play this game. I believe in respecting the human dignity of human persons and their individual freedom of conscience. And I'm going to do another episode, hopefully this week or next week, about why coerced and mandated vaccines are a very bad idea. They won't just, and this is what this policy is actually doing here. This business owner actually is contributing, if he goes ahead with this, I think will be contributing to social harm. What he will be doing is actually helping to foment a very unhealthy distrust and division between people in society. It's really not healthy, and his business is acting in a way that I would call commercially irresponsible at that point. I really do believe that. I believe that human dignity matters, that freedom of conscience is part of that. As I said, I've got a future episode coming up about why I think, practically speaking, having enforced vaccine mandates is a bad idea, not just because of the social harms that it can cause. I think the harm to medicine and medical trust is extremely serious that this kind of thing can cause. And there's other issues as well. So I promise we're going to talk about that in a future episode. And again, I'll go back to that first caveat I started with. This is not a COVID-only podcast, but these issues are important and they're great opportunities, I think, to unpack and explore the ethics, which don't just apply to COVID ultimately. They apply in other areas of human society as well. And I think we need to consider. And I think if this gives us an opportunity to think more deeply by honing in on the COVID example, to think about deeper ethical and broader ethical principles, that's a really good thing. I think we can all learn from that. Now, the second issue though here, and this is what was originally the main focus of this today's episode, was the fact that the New Zealand Herald newspaper is now running a vaccination campaign. When I saw this over the weekend or late last week when they announced this, I have to say I was stunned when I saw this. Now, I really mean that. Again, this is not hyperbole. I was like, what? So initially I thought, are they just helping are they just reporting on the government scheme? I was a little bit confused at first. And so I thought, I'd better go and double check this. And when I went and looked at their site and what they're saying, and I realized, no, they're actually running their own vaccination campaign called the 90% Project. And what they want to do is, let me read the headline, the 90% Project, New Zealand Herald campaign to vaccinate Kiwis, save lives, and enjoy freedom. They've got videos, they've got web pages, they've got graphics dedicated to it. And what they're saying is, we're campaigning, New Zealanders, to try and get 90% of the population vaccinated by Christmas. They are running a public health campaign. And look, how do I put this? First of all, this is not journalism. This is absolutely not journalism, what these people are doing. Look, the point is here, there's no problem with public vaccination campaigns, but it is not appropriate for them to be run, I personally don't think, by anyone other than the appropriate public health authorities, not a newspaper. A newspaper should not be, the media should not be in the business of running vaccination campaigns. Why? Well, first of all, there's an old adage in journalism that, you know, you shouldn't become the story or be in the story. Well, they really are the story now when they're doing this. They are absolutely the story. It's not just a journalist who's perhaps inserted themselves into the story too much. They have become the story. I'm really interested to know, and I couldn't quite see, but maybe I've missed something. The first thing I thought of really was, well, who advised them on the 90% target, and who advised them on Christmas as the sort of the cutoff point for that, or was the target time for that? To me, and this is where, you know, this is the thing. Public health policy campaigns should be run by public health authorities and by public health policy experts, I think. Otherwise, what you've got here is a situation where this looks an awful lot like a newspaper that is just running government propaganda. Now, they might be right in what they're trying to get people to do. That's not the point. The point is that they've crossed a boundary that I don't think the media should cross ever. You see, here's the important point. How can I now trust the New Zealand Herald and any of their reporting on vaccine safety and efficacy? That's a really important question, it seems to me. How can we trust them? Because they're now running their own campaign. So are they going to report information that would challenge or pose a hindrance to the campaign that they are running? I mean, I'm just astounded. Even as I'm speaking to you now and saying this out loud, I'm just becoming more astounded about what's coming out of my mouth, because I'm thinking, this is crazy. This is what the media needs to be doing, is not this. Like, again, there's other areas of trust as well. How can we trust their reporting on vaccine targets, or even the reliability or the prudence of mass vaccine policies, etc.? So what if scientists want to raise legitimate questions, who are experts in this field, about whether we should be conducting a mass vaccine campaign right now? Will the Herald cover that with genuine integrity? I'm sorry, but I can't trust them while they're running a vaccine campaign of their own. And it got even weirder, by the way, in the last 24 hours or so, or 48 hours. The New Zealand Herald, as part of this 90% campaign, or the 90% project, they're calling it, they published a list of MPs, all of our MPs, and what their vaccination status is. My first thought was, hold on a minute, what are you doing here? Have you considered what you're actually doing? You are singling out, and you are, so any MP who's not vaccinated is effectively being singled out here. It's also giving away information, healthcare information, about MPs that I don't think should be in the public space. Now, if any person, whether they're an MP or a public figure or a private person, if they want to publicly announce their own vaccination status and decision making, they should be free to do that. That's fine. That's their own free decision to make, and no problem at all there. But when you've got a media outlet running a campaign listing the status, the vaccination status, and listing MPs whether they are vaccinated or not and what state they're up to in the vaccination process, I would say, how is that helping? How is that anything other than a really unhelpful and a very, I would suggest, dangerous precedent to set? You are othering and creating a vilification potential that's very real here. You might think, but I think you'd probably have to be very naive to think that it would just roll out positively only, that people will just look at this and go, oh, that's so lovely. But in actual fact, doing this kind of thing actually creates very real opportunities and social vilification around groups of people, the clean and the unclean. And I've talked about this previously. Most people seem completely unaware of this, that wherever you have moments of genocide and other human rights atrocities that involve dehumanization, they almost always began with a vision for national health, what the perfect vision of national health, a healthy society, would look like, what the traits are, and then included with that is a categorization of people who are deemed to be unhealthy and a threat to the health of the nation. And whether the Herald likes it or not, they are playing into that very kind of behaviour by doing this. I don't think that's their intent, or I really hope that's not their intent. I don't think it is, but this is so poorly considered. Here's the thing. The Fourth Estate, the media, should not be doing this. I don't know how clearly I can say this. They shouldn't be doing this. I think a boundary's been crossed here, just even with the fact that they are running a vaccination campaign. Because the role of the media, I think that's the job of the government and the government health authorities to do that kind of thing. And the job of the media is to keep those campaigns and those policies, their job is to keep them accountable. Their job is to report on them. It is to critique and ask questions when and where that is appropriate. And of course, to allow the various authorities to purchase advertising space to promote their campaigns. It is not the job, though, of the media to be running their own vaccination campaign. They've crossed a line, and it means that they can't be considered to be a completely neutral, well, they're not a neutral source on these issues anymore. And that creates a massive conflict of interest. And I am absolutely astounded that no one at the Herald stopped at any point. Well, they don't seem to have, and said, hey, maybe this is a line that we shouldn't be crossing. What this tells me and what this speaks to is two things. Number one is it speaks to the politicization and the boundary crossing that has happened all over this pandemic, and the way that appropriate boundaries and transparencies and points of accountability have become so seriously eroded. And this is just one example of that, and the fact that a newspaper just wouldn't even really think twice about that. Secondly, it speaks to the way in which now the media has, this is part of the reason why there is a trust problem that the public has with the mainstream media. It's despite the fact that there are still some good journalists trying to do good work, there is a culture and a series of behaviours that have arisen within the media that have undermined public trust. And I would suggest to you that this is an example of something that actually does that. Because what you've got is a situation where the media has crossed a boundary, and as someone I saw recently once put it, you've got journalists who are having employment identity confusion issues here. They are acting as if they are employed to do a different job than what they actually should be doing, and that creates a real problem for reliability and trust. It really, really does. And so it's not just this issue. I've seen other places where they've actually not running campaigns, but they have acted as activists. They have actively lobbied for law changes and things in other areas. And I really firmly believe, I don't care what the history of this is, I think an ethical journalism is one that says, look, we actually can't be doing this. We need, unless I'd say the exception would be this, that they are lobbying for a change which is relates to their particular industry. So their ability as journalists to be better truth tellers and to be less hindered in telling the truth and ensuring accountability. But absolutely for certain, and there might be some other isolated examples where we might say, well, maybe we could have a quibble over whether or not they should be doing advocacy in that way. But I think absolutely in this situation, I don't think they should be running a vaccination campaign. I think at a time when we actually need accountability, where we've got a situation where ordinary lay people are under a lot of pressure from governments that are desperate to get out of a situation. There's a global state of fear. There are huge corporations who have got very, very serious interests and financial gain to be made by getting lots of people vaccinated. I'm saying that's not a reason not to get vaccinated, but it is a pointer where you need the media to actually provide some protection and to give assurance to the public that factor is not overwhelming truth or good policy, etc. So for all those reasons, this shouldn't be happening. In a nutshell, the government should be running public health policy and not the media, and I think it's a problem that boundary has been crossed. As I said earlier, thanks for tuning in to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're not already a subscriber to the podcast, wherever you're listening right now, why not hit that little subscribe, that follow button, and make sure you share these episodes with friends and family and tell them to do the same. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time on The Dispatches. The Dispatches podcast is a production of Left Foot Media. If you enjoyed this show, then please help us to ensure that more of this great content keeps getting made by becoming a patron of our work at patreon.com/leftfootmedia. Link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. See you next time on The Dispatches.